Hi, everybody. Welcome back. Beyond the Matrix is back with you. The program that dares you to think outside the box of convention. And we surely have been doing that in the weeks that have passed. And we are going to do that tonight a la grande with an amazing story, an amazing author, an amazing man. So I will have him on in just a minute. I want to remind you all, I'm in Egypt as we speak. This is a pre-recorded interview. So while you're hearing this interview, know that I'm climbing around with a group of people in the sacred sites in Egypt. And please have tune in to us and see if you could pick up on some of those amazing energies that we're going to be, that we will be in and sharing with the planet. All right. I have with me tonight, and remember, I always say tonight because I'm in Italy, so it's night here, day there. I have quite a remarkable person. His name is Jesse Marcel. He's written a book called The Roswell Legacy, The Untold Story of the First Military Officer at the 1947 Crash Site. Now, this is a really an amazing book. Jesse talks about his father, who was the first military person to go into the site, and he's got what I would consider probably the truest first-hand information, having been with his father when his father came home and shared this with the family. The story is quite remarkable, and I know you're going to love hearing from him. So let me just give you a little bit about him. Jesse Marcel was born in August 30th, 1936 in Houston. He is a retired military officer who served as a medical officer in the United States Navy. He joined the Navy in 1962. Just in time to participate in the Cuban Missile Crisis, serving on board a troop transport ship. Prior to joining the Navy, Marcel attended Louisiana State University School of Medicine, graduating in 1961. And while in the Navy, he received specialty training in, I'm going to try to pronounce it, otolaryngology. And upon leaving the Navy in 1971, opened a medical practice in Helena, Montana. He joined the Montana National Guard as a medical officer and earned his flight surgeon wings in Alabama. Now, I'm telling you all of this because it's important that we have here a very credible person, a person who is a trained military person. He's a trained medic. He has all the credentials that I certainly don't have when I tell my stories about ETs and my opinions about life beyond this planet. And certainly he and certainly his father have the credentials to warrant being listened to very attentively. The book is also introduced by Stanton Freeman, who you know I all love. He's been on the show three times. Stanton also becoming involved to help Jesse get the story out. So here he is with a great applause. Jesse, thank you so much for coming on Beyond the Matrix.
Well, you're more than welcome. Pleasure's mine.
You certainly have such an incredible list of credentials. It's going to be wonderful to be able to bring that to the remarkable story that you've told in the book. And I think that we'll start by just asking you, first of all, how wonderful it must have been to have had such an experience, how very few people on this planet have had your experience.
Well,
at least that we know about.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was an eye-opener. You know, it sure made me realize the immensity of the universe that we live in, that we certainly are not the only civilization, that there's others out there and certainly more further along in their science than we are, because they can travel through interstellar space that we so far are really scratching the very beginnings of right now.
And it is interesting that there's so much of a focus now on the potential of contact in this moment of 2012 approaching and all of this emphasis on what's going to happen at that time, and so it's all the more important that your story has come out now.
Well, yes.
But I do want to ask you, what took you, and I know you talk about this in the book, what took you so long to come out with the story? This happened when you were 11, right?
Right. Well, you know, there's been a lot of books written about this, and first of all, I wanted to write a book that establishes my dad's credibility, that he was who he said he was, that he was an intelligence officer. He went through all kinds of schooling through the Army Air Force, and he was a very credible person. His his OER reports were good. You know, a lot of skeptics, you know, try to do this. If they don't like the message, they kill the messenger. Well, that's what
yes.
happened. So basically the book was to, you know, set the pattern straight, you know, that he was who he was.
And he made you promise that you would tell the story, see the story to be told, right?
Right. You know, we just wanted to, you know, let more time go by. And I'm getting along in years myself, and I wanted to write the book while I still could.
I was very touched by the fact that in the book you say that while you were in Iraq, you, and really questioning your own mortality, you realized that it was possible the story would die with you, and this is one of the motivations you had to bring it out.
Yeah, well, you know, it's we were under continual mortar attacks here, so what I would do, I'd not to cry baby, but I would wrap my computer in my flak vest when I took it off at night, just in case a mortar came through, at least the computer would survive with my book on it. You know?
Oh, wow, that's heavy. Well, we're glad you both survived and the story
yeah,
was
I'm
told.
Glad, I'm happy with that, too.
So, all right, so let's get into this. You were, I'm just amazed by this story. Of course, I am a diehard investigator of not only extraterrestrial, but also extra-dimensional contact, and have followed this since I was a child. So I am not by any chance a skeptic and very excited about your story. And we have heard varying tales about the debris and whatever, and I love the fact that you personally have seen this debris, and you're going to talk about what you saw.
Well, you know, when it unfolded, you know, my dad, of course, being the intelligence officer at the Roswell Army Airfield, was dispatched to a ranch outside of Roswell where something had crashed on this ranch's land. It's the Foster Ranch. And Mac Brazel, who was the ranch foreman, saw this field just covered with unusual debris. And initially contacted the sheriff at Chavez County, who then contacted Colonel Blanchard, the base commander at Roswell. And so Blanchard sent my dad and the CIC agent, Sheridan Cavett, out to the field to collect representative portions of the debris because they didn't know where it was. And when my dad got out there, he said, well, what, you know, he did not, no, he realized this was not a normal aircraft or anything that he'd ever seen.
Not a weather balloon?
No, it was not a weather balloon. And, the cover story, of course, is that this is just parts of a radar target from a weather balloon or a mogul balloon. But, you know, my dad had gone to a radar school, so he knew what radar targets looked like. And that was not what this was. But anyway, you know, he gathered up portions of the debris, and our house happened to be on the way to the base that night. And so he realized that he wanted to show my mother and myself this, whatever it was. So he swung by the house. And I had spread some of the debris out on the kitchen floor and got my mother and myself up to look at this. And it must have been really late at night, maybe 1 o'clock in the morning by that time. And so he got me up. I looked at all this debris. I saw, what is this? You know, just a lot of metal fragments. And you know, at first I thought, well, why is he so excited about this junk, you know, looking material? And his excitement was that he thought this was part of what he called a flying saucer.
Wow.
And
now, why was he allowed to stop home and show you this stuff?
Well, at that time, it was not classified. It was just debris that was in the field, and it was not classified. Then it became later very classified, very secure. So
did he eventually tell them that he'd brought some home? And because where did this end up is what I'm, of course,
well, you know,
heading
I'm not
for.
Sure, I'm not sure he really told anybody about that, but when Colonel Blanchard realized the enormity of this discovery, he sent my dad on a mission to Fort Worth to see General Rickney, who is the 8th Air Force commander. So my dad flew some of this wreckage in a B-29 under armed guard to Fort Worth Army Airfield, and he showed General Rickney what this was. And that's where the
cover story. And what did the general make out of it? What did they make out of it when he showed it?
Well,
Hello?
Yeah.
You're cutting out.
Hello?
Hello?
I had some phone troubles here.
Okay, are you with me?
Yeah, I'm with you now. So, but anyway,
okay,
you know,
great. So you said that he presented it to the general, and then what happened?
Well, you know, there were some pictures taken of the debris by Walt Bond Johnson, one of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram photographers. And I saw those pictures much later. And what it does, it showed my dad holding a very typical radar target to begin the cover story that this was just a misidentification. And but I knew that's not what it was because I saw the debris myself. And it was.
But is the picture that's on your website of him holding up a false...
Yeah, that's...
In other words, a photo op of him holding up something different, or is that actually a piece of the debris?
No, that's something different. That's a radar target.
So in other words, they said, let's take a few shots?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that was cover up. My dad was then told, under no circumstances was he ever to talk about this again, and that's where the cover story, you know, cover up was. This was just a radar target from a weather balloon, which of course it was not.
So tell us about what, in fact, you know, when you were first exposed to this. I can imagine coming out of a deep sleep in your jammies, coming down to seeing this stuff must have been a little bit disconcerting. But what were your discoveries? Tell us, please, about the matter itself.
Okay, the first thing I wanted us to do was look for any electronic components like vacuum tubes or resistors or condensers, and there wasn't anything like that in this. But he already knew that. And I looked at the foil. It could have been confused with aluminum foil from, you know, the kitchen wrap of today, but it was not that. I really can't, you know, explain the differences there. But the most unusual part was that the I-beams that had the strange lettering or symbols on the inner surface of it.
That is amazing.
And you know, it was they were kind of purplish, violet hue, semi-reflective of light, and they were small. They looked like geometric symbols, like spheroids, triangular shapes, things like that. And they were solid in nature. They were not the line drawings. But that was...
Were they etched into the metal?
You know, I don't remember. You know, I'm not sure I tried running my finger along the inside edge of this. But it was, you know, strange. It's kind of hard to describe it.
Okay, but you're the one that discovered these symbols, yeah?
I like to think I was. My mother said that, no, she saw them first, but I think I showed it to the rest of the family that there were some very strange markings on the metal. I think my dad probably had already seen that, though. He just loved
and, of course, this all went back to the base. Nothing was left in some family
chest. Absolutely.
Chest.
He transported every scrap of it back to the base there, and I wish I had kept a piece of it, but I kind of think had I done so, I would not have it now. So...
Yeah, we might not have you now if you had done that.
Everybody asked,
okay,
why?
So,
Everybody, why didn't you keep a piece of it? Well, no, it was not. It was Air Force material, so it was not mine to keep a piece of it.
Yeah, I mean, hindsight is a bummer, isn't it?
Yeah.
You described this, and I've heard it described before, how this metal at first seemed like aluminum, even tin foil. Yet it was really, really strong, and when you bent it, or I think your father folded it, and went back to its original form.
Yeah,
is that right?
No, I did not witness that myself, but my dad did, and he told us that it was like metal with a memory. If you crumpled it up, it would uncrumple, and other people have described the same feature, but I myself did not do that because I didn't try to bend it or do anything with it like that. I wish I would have.
Well, that's pretty interesting. Metal with a memory. That speaks to some pretty intense technology.
Yeah, well, I say so. I guess we have that now, but certainly not in 1947.
We have that now?
Well, you know, I think there's a metal alloy that has this, you know, if you twist it, it'll untwist like a wire that strains itself out. If you heated it, it assumes its normal position.
I remember also reading somewhere that it could be rolled up into a ball and bounced. Is that right?
You know, I don't, you know, like I said, I didn't see that. Other people might have seen that physical feature, but I did not see that.
Okay, so your experience was that the memory of that discovery of those pieces all over the kitchen, and the most important thing is seeing those symbols.
Well, that's right. That was it really sticks in my mind with the symbols.
So how did this affect you personally, at such a young age, having had what would appear to be proof of some form of alien arrival on this planet?
Well, what it did, it made me very interested in astronomy and cosmology, because at that point I realized that we're not the only ones around. And also it kind of made my faith in God a little bit stronger, too, because I realized that He created more than just us. And it certainly made me interested in astronomy and cosmology. And I have a telescope, and I read everything I can about the Hubble telescope findings and everything like that. So it primarily engendered an interest in astronomy for me.
And have you been seeing interesting things in the night skies?
Yeah, you know, I guess I've never seen anything I really could not identify. I guess the strangest thing I saw was actually, strangely enough, in Iraq. I was flying back between Kirkuk and Balad in a pair of Black Hawk helicopters, and of course there are no running lights, no visible lights on the helicopters because they're all infrared, and because you didn't want the bad guys to see you to shoot at you. But I did see a bright light flying or skimming the ground from going from south to north up toward Turkey, and it was not a civilian aircraft because that was a no-fly zone. So here was this light just skimming the ground, going pretty fast, and who knows what that was. But
that's interesting because there have been a number of sightings in Turkey. When was that? Do you remember anything specific?
That's probably the spring of 2005.
Hello? Hello?
What?
Hello?
Yeah, my phones are going crazy here.
Yeah, are you sitting in, are you moving around?
Yeah, I was trying to find a better location for this, but it doesn't seem to make any difference.
You're cutting out.
How about now? Is it better now?
Well, I hear you, but then you cut out.
Oh, is that right? Well.
Hello?
Yeah, do you hear me now?
Yeah, okay. Maybe if you try not to move, we will see if we can get through this.
I'll stay put here. Okay, so.
Yeah.
But I think what it was, the phone battery was going dead and that other one, so I switched to another phone.
Okay, so you've got another phone now, or we're good to go, as they say in the military.
Yeah.
Good to go.
Good to go.
Okay. All right. Speaking of the military, obviously you've probably had some resistance to this material. Why do you think the government is still covering up Roswell?
You know, I don't know. I think it's a story that needs to be told. That people need to realize for sure that our government has recovered extraterrestrial craft, that there's civilizations out there who were interested in us. And I think that it's not a secret that people couldn't take. You know, I don't think it'd be like the War of the Worlds phenomenon of like in 1938 when everybody panicked at this Orson Welles, broadcast this on Mercury Theater. But I think people can now take the fact that our civilization is not by itself, that we do have visitors from time to time from other places. But I don't know why they would keep that a secret. Because, you know, it's not just the U.S. government either. There are other governments in the world, too. Because this is a worldwide...
Yeah, you're cutting out again.
Oh. Huh.
Jesse?
Yes, I hear you.
Keep cutting out on me.
Oh, for Pete's sakes.
Yeah, okay, let's see. You've got a better phone, and you're in a place where you're not moving around.
That's right.
Well, maybe we have intervention.
Yeah, I hear you perfectly, you know. I hear you.
All right, well, we'll keep going through that. Maybe if you can speak a little bit more slowly so that if I miss something, I can
I'll pick up on it.
I can make it out because of the timing.
Okay.
Or the phrasing.
All right,
let's talk about, I'd love to talk about your experiences then as an 11-year-old. When this came down and your father was, let's say, I'm sure it was top secret even for the family. How was it evolving in him as a person? Did you see him? Did he keep his military face, or was he deeply affected by this?
Well, you know, he was a good soldier, and I think, you know, we all realized what this was, and we put it kind of on the back burner because we were not to talk about it. As a matter of fact, when my dad came back from Fort Worth, he sat my mother and myself down and said under no circumstances were we to ever talk about this again. But I'm talking about it now. But the effect it had on him was kind of difficult to assess. He kind of kept it close to his chest, and I don't think it really bothered him any way, you know, because he was told to keep it a secret. He was just a good soldier following orders.
Because what?
He was a good soldier, and he's following orders to keep it a secret. So he kept this close to his chest, and I don't think it really bothered him that much.
Jesse?
Yes.
This is really becoming very difficult to interview you because the phone just keeps cutting out. Okay, we're back with Jesse Marcel. We had some telephone difficulties. Let's see how it was working now. Are you with me, Jesse?
Yes, I am.
Oh, this is better. Much, much better.
Oh, great, great.
Okay, good. I'm so happy about that. All right, listen, for those of you who are just listening in, I would like you to know that I'm interviewing Jesse Marcel. He's the son of Jesse Marcel Sr., who was the first military person to enter the Roswell crash scene. His website is www.theroswelllegacy.com. You're going to want to read that, and you're really going to want to read the book, The Roswell Legacy. I've just read it. It's quite an amazing affidavit to what really took place in Roswell, and after all of the conjecture, it's a very concise little bit of information about what took place from someone who lived it. All right, so we were talking about your dad, and he was a real good soldier, and he kept a straight face, but it sure is a heavy thing to have to keep concealed, having experienced this firsthand, don't you think?
Well, yeah, I think so, but again, he, being a good soldier, he was put it in the background, and he actually went along with a cover-up, because I heard him say one time that, heck, he was part of a cover-up, and he was in favor of it at that time, but later in his life, I think that he realized that it's a story that had to be told. And in 1978, I guess, he talked to Stanton Friedman about this and divulged the story as he knew it at that time.
Now, Stanton Friedman is the guy to get the story out, isn't he?
Yes, he is. He's
I'm glad that he helped you bring out this story.
Yeah, he's Stanton Friedman is a very close friend of the family, and I really like him.
I do, too. I admire him very much. And how was it like being a boy and having I can't imagine as a child having this story and not being able to share it with your friends.
Well, you know, like my dad, I thought, well, it's there. You know, I accept for what it was, and I just kept it close to my chest, too. I really never really brought the subject up with my friends.
All right, what about the farmer? You read in the book that the rancher, he went out, he found all this debris, the sheep were all to one side of it, and they wouldn't go anywhere, they had to get to the water, but they wouldn't go near it, they wouldn't go around it.
Yes.
To get to their water. So they could definitely feel the oddness or the energy emanating from this field of material.
Yeah, but you know, interviewed by the Air Force too, and he's told in no certain terms that he is not to talk about it anymore. But so they contacted everybody who had anything to do with this, and keep it undercover.
Now, wasn't there also a craft found? I mean, this is where the story gets a little bit strange. I mean, we have stories that there was a craft found and a body in the craft. Do you have any recall of this story, or in your life experience since then? Does this equate with anything you know?
Basically, just when I read about that, I realized that apparently there was two crash sites. There was the debris field that my dad was associated with, but then there was a crash site some distance away where the main bulk of the craft came down. And if there are bodies there, that's where they're located. But my dad had nothing to do with the bodies. He probably had no knowledge of them at that time.
And so what do you think of that story?
Well, you know, I guess I'm a little skeptic, but a lot of people have reported it, so I have to go along with the majority opinion on this thing.
It's hard to believe that you're skeptical about it, considering that you were right in the middle of this whole story.
Well, you know, I guess that I have to believe. I do believe it. You know, I wish I'd have seen it. You know, I'm kind of like one of these guys who, you know, seeing is believing, and wish I'd have seen that part also. But, you know, I accept it for what it is, you know, because there are too many reports on it by credible people.
And your wife, has she been involved in this? Retelling this story with you? I see her name is on the book.
Well, she kind of talked about what effect it had on my younger children there. They were at first kind of frightened about the fact that that we're not alone. But so she wrote a little bit about the effect that it had on the family, on my immediate family.
So she also believes we're not alone.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, it's getting more and more clear when people like nuclear physicists and generals in the military are coming out with these stories that we've got the people with the credentials and the left-brain rationality to bring the story forward.
Yeah, I think it's just a matter of time before the secret is divulged. And but why they keep hanging on to the cover-up, I don't know. But I hope they do release this before I die, but I already know what it was, so I'm satisfied in my own mind that what I saw.
Up to date on some of the other major sightings that are going on around the world?
Well, yeah, I do kind of have a little interest. You know, I watch the History Channel and about their discoveries, the UFO hunters and people like that who are really doing good research on this. So I do kind of keep up with it on television.
And what do you think about the Phoenix Lights?
Well, I talked to some people who saw them, and by gosh, they're convinced that these were not flares dropped from an A-10 someplace, that some sort of a craft that overflew the Phoenix. And they're very credible people, and I believe them.
When you say very credible, they're military people?
Well, you know, these are people, observers, first-hand witnesses. I've talked with them, at meetings, and they're convinced that what they saw was some sort of a craft, and not just these flares that were dropped at some military training exercise. And knowing the type of person that saw these, I believe the story. And
so can you tell us a little bit about what they saw, what they told you they saw happening in the sky?
Well, it just, you know, it just kind of regurgitated what everybody else has been saying. There's a formation of lights that overflew Phoenix, seen by, I guess, the governor also. So, you know, I don't know any more about that, because I was not a first-hand witness to this. All I could do is just...
Right, but apparently the story came out, it was reported and photographed actually very well, and then the cover-up came out that these were flares, right?
Yeah, they proved that they weren't flares, I believe. So I don't know what it was. You know, lights in the sky, what does that mean? But same kind of a light that I saw in Iraq that time. But light in the sky, I wish I would have seen the craft it was on. But didn't do that.
So let me ask you, why do you feel that there has not been a breakthrough contact from extraterrestrials?
Well, my personal feeling is that based on our history of warfare, you know, we're very aggressive. We are a very aggressive civilization, and I think that that we would pose a greater risk to them than they to us. And they probably are keeping us at arm's distance because of our warlike tendencies. Shoot first.
But that's interesting that you would say that, because when I asked Stanton Freeman this question, he said, "Well, if we would just stop shooting at everything."
Yeah, all right. You know, we should first ask questions later. And, you know, we're too primitive for them to contact us.
Boy, that is really a sad statement about the state of affairs on planet Earth, isn't it?
Oh, it is. You know, I was watching features about the bombing of Japan and the World War II, World War I, the horrible atrocities that occurred there. You know, we're very savage. We're very savage.
Yeah, we are, and we don't seem to be improving here. I mean, I want to be an optimist about the future of humankind, but we seem to just not understand that we are a self-annihilating society.
Yeah, just going back thousands of years. I agree, you know, we've advanced technologically, but sociologically we have not advanced. We're very primitive in that.
And we seem to be using technology to advance our savagery. It's really very disconcerting.
It is. You know, it's a very sad commentary on all of us.
It is. What do you think the future holds for humankind?
Well, I hope we survive ourselves, you know. We've survived a thousand years, and I think we will. Maybe sooner or later, we will finally give up all our weaponry and our warlike tendencies, but that's not going to happen.
You think we'll finally get it?
I hope so. I pray to God that we do.
Well, there are a lot of people like me, I'm one of them, who, I admit, believe that we are going to have massive contact soon. And, of course, I'm not saying that from a scientific point of view, but I do really believe that all of these sightings around the world are harbingers of a mass contact to come. And
well,
the question is, in fact, will we shoot this out when we do have? Let's just play this out. We've got contact at let's say 10 points on the planet. Imagine a scenario where we've got craft flying into different points of the planet. How do you suppose the human race would react?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, President Reagan gave a very famous speech here at the United Nations talking about, you know, if we realize that there's a threat from without, maybe that would make us live with ourselves a little bit better. You know, maybe we drop some of our aggressiveness toward each other. So, it's hard to say how humankind would
react. Reagan said that?
Yes, he did.
That's surprising.
In the United Nations. He says, just suppose.
Well, definitely. I mean, if you've got, you know, everybody pointing guns at each other and every point of every continent is ablaze here, and then suddenly you've got craft flying overhead, it would be the natural instinct to lay down your gun a minute and look up and go, whoa.
Yeah. I was hoping it would not be a contact like Independence Day, like the movie portrayed, but who knows. But I don't think these other civilizations mean us any harm, because if we had anything they wanted, we wouldn't be here now. So I think they're kind of benign. They just are interested in this and see how we do if we survive our own technology.
Survive ourselves. Well, that's good to hear, because some people believe that there are all kinds of every kind of concept is out there now about ET contact with the human race. And, of course, there's a lot being said about abduction and their taking of our DNA. Could you speak to that?
Well, again, I'm not a researcher. I'm just an observer on this one occasion. My theory is, though, that they're interested in us, in our technology, our civilization, and they may have some interest in our anatomy too, so to speak, and maybe some of these abduction scenarios are actually happening where they take samples of DNA and things like that just like we would a primitive animal and to study it.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that people that all of these people that are declaring they've been abducted are, maybe not all, but do you believe these are true experiences?
Well, I recognize the possibility of it. Since I have not been abducted myself, I don't know just what it is, but there are a lot of reports about this that are credible, and you have to kind of believe that maybe something indeed is happening. I don't think it's happening as often as people say it is, but I'm sure that there are some reports that are actually, bona fide.
Well, knowing Stanton as well as you do, you probably know quite a lot about the Andreessen affair. Barney and Betty Hill.
Oh, yeah. I Interrupted Journey. They wrote a book about that.
I had Stanton on the first time he was on my show. We talked about that incident. That is a pretty remarkable story as well.
Well, it is, especially when you look at the star map that Betty drew out, because she put stars there that we didn't realize they were there until much later. Her map was very accurate.
It's so hard to visualize this map because it was a 3D structure, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
How did they create that?
I'm sorry?
When she was shown this star map, for those of you who are listening, Betty Hill claimed that she was on the craft. They were pretty benevolent, these beings on the craft, especially the leader, let's say, and he showed her a map of where they came from. And was it a hologram, as you know, Jesse?
It sounds like that's what it was. It was a kind of hologram of some kind.
Yeah, I think she was shown a 3D hologram of this star system and then tried to draw it. And later, wasn't it recreated at some university in a 3D structure or something?
Yeah, there's a researcher who recreated the star map, and it showed trade routes between some of the major systems there and our relative's position in that star map.
It showed trade routes?
Yes. If you look at the star map that Betty drew, she indicated there are trade routes between some of the star systems.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's remarkable.
Yeah, it is a reprint in the Astronomy magazine some years ago.
Wow. How can we get our hands, for the people that are listening and for me too, get our hands on more information about that? Would you know?
No. Again, this came out in the Astronomy Magazine years ago. I guess there are some reprints made, but they probably are not available now.
Well, we'll have to look for that. If anybody finds that, please get in touch with me at info@SyrianRevelations.net, because I would love to take a look at that.
Well, yes, Stan Friedman had some reprints, too, and he's written about the star map that Betty drew.
Okay, Stanton would be the guy to ask for sure. Are you going to be speaking at the UFO conference in Las Vegas?
No. I have no plans to go to Las Vegas. I think I'll go to Roswell on this coming July, but right now I don't have any plans for conferences.
So is there an event coming up at Roswell?
Well, every year on the 4th of July they have this big splash. It's, Chamber of Commerce takes advantage of this event there. And there will be some guest speakers there.
Are you one?
I think, yes, I will be one.
Okay, so would you like to tell the audience that's listening when that will be so people can have the opportunity to come and hear you speak?
Well, it'll be on the 4th or 5th of July of this year in Roswell. It'll be, I'm not sure where the location is. I don't know if it's been selected yet. It's just now being put together.
You'll put that up on your website when you know?
Yes, I'll do that. You know, I'd like to make a correction on the website. It's not the one that you gave is no longer active. The website now is jessemarcelsenior.com. That's, jessemarcelsr.com. That's the website they can contact.
Ah, okay, because I'm looking at the Roswell Legacy site.
Yeah.
That's no longer valid.
Yeah, it's no longer valid.
Okay, jessemarcelsenior.com.
Yeah.
Is senior spelled out or is it SR?
Just SR.
Okay, great. Right. All right. So now one of the questions that you suggested we discuss is whether or not there's been any reverse engineering. I don't understand what you mean by that question, and I would appreciate it if you would explain it, please.
Okay. You know, reverse engineering, of course, is where you take a complicated craft and try to glean information from it so you can reproduce it, so to speak. And it does take a certain amount of technology to be able to reverse engineer any kind of machinery. And I'm just not sure that we have the technology at this point to really get to the nitty-gritty of reverse engineering. It'd be almost like giving a digital wristwatch to Da Vinci and asking him to reproduce it. I don't think he could because he didn't have the technology. That doesn't mean to say we won't have the technology in years to come, but I have my doubts as to how much reverse engineering has been done because of that.
So what you mean is that they would be taking these little pieces of debris and trying to reconstruct the craft?
Yeah. I have my doubts that we're, our technology would allow us to do that. But maybe I'm wrong. That's just my theory.
As far as our technology goes, where do we stand with our own foraging into space? I mean, obviously, this is a very loaded question. I don't expect you to tell us the secrets of NASA, but as far as you are in the know, what's the prognosis here for us really really getting out and getting, for example, and I personally believe there is life on Mars. We've got two craft there now, maybe three. What's the deal?
Well, I think that the future is bright for our own research. I think that NASA is putting a lot of funds into space technology, and there's a lot of theories on how you can travel in space without using chemical rockets and so forth. That maybe there are theories about how space itself can be warped, and you can actually exceed the speed of light in an external time frame. So yeah, I think that will do it. And with our rate of development, I think it may not be too much further down the road there.
Well, in the book you talk about tapping the zero point field. Can you try to make that understandable to me and to who's listening?
Well, in the fabric of space, there's an incredible amount of energy locked up. And It's just a matter of tapping this energy. You know, it's been proven that there's energy there. And like Hal Puthoff, who's doing research on this, said, you know, the proof of principle is there. All it takes now is engineering. So who knows, maybe 10 years, 100 years, we'll be able to tap this energy. And once we do that, we can then apply that to warping space and maybe exceed the speed of light between planetary systems without the, having tremendous mass develop.
Exceeding the speed of light is something that I find very fascinating, even though they say that physically it's not possible. On the other hand, in your book, too, you say that in space it is possible.
Well, there's ways of getting around the law of Einstein. You know, in your own space-time continuum, you cannot exceed the speed of light, but that doesn't mean that your continuum cannot be made to exceed the speed of light to an outside reference point. And I think that's
right,
how
it is. Right, but
that
you just simply escape your own space-time continuum where there are new laws.
Yeah. You can, in your own space-time, you can be at rest, but your space-time itself can be made to exceed the speed of light because there's no limit to how fast space can expand.
Do you believe that this kind of exploration is taking place now and that we are at the break of the breaking point of discovery?
Well, like Hal Puthoff said, you know, the proof of principle is there, and it just takes the engineering to do this. And how much time it will take us to get to the actual phase of this thing where we're actually doing it, who knows. But at the rate we're going with our own scientific technology, it may not be that much longer.
Well, if we could just spend some of the money we're spending on war, on discovery, maybe we'd get there even a little bit faster.
I think so. But, you know, that's just the way we are. We're put together like that. We're just a warlike species.
Well, I'm encouraged to hear you say that you believe that they will be benevolent, and hopefully we are on the verge of maybe not just discovering, but rediscovering that we aren't orphans on this planet, because we do see records throughout history of contact, or at least signs that there has been presence on the Earth. Look at the Egyptian records, look at the Syrian tablets.
Oh, yeah, they've been around for a while. You know, look at cave, and, a cave art, would indicate that there's some flying saucers or strange craft out there. There's paintings, done by the medieval artists, which clearly demonstrate a flying saucer, So they've been around for a long, long time, and we're still here. So that's why I say they're not, I don't think they're malevolent toward us, because if they were, we wouldn't be here.
Well, that's very encouraging to people who are sometimes indoctrinated by the outrageous media that we see and, like that terrible movie. What was it, The War of the Worlds?
Yeah.
I mean, that was just really, really, really offensive. I really resent that ever being made, the remake that was made by Steven Spielberg, who once did some beautiful work on the potential of life beyond the planet, but he seems to have swung over to the dark side.
Yeah. Well, bad news sells newspapers, so maybe that's what it was,
That's true. Fear sells as well. Tell me, Jesse, what do you want people to take away from this book? You obviously have dedicated an important part of your life coveting that computer in the middle of your war zone so that your story would come out. What is this? What do you want people to take away from this story?
Well, I want them to take away from the story that that our civilization is not by itself, that there are certainly more advanced civilizations out there, that we need to maybe settle our own warlike tendencies so that maybe they will contact us. But the main thing is to let people know that, hey, we're not alone, that there are other civilizations out there, certainly more advanced than we are. Because they've learned a little.
You can't help but think that since you've seen their symbols, they might just decide to make you one of the first people to stop in and see.
Well, if they did, my first question is how do you do it? How do you travel from here, from wherever you came from? That'd be my first question.
Yeah, I just love the wormhole theory and the idea that our concept of space is very limited to our own perception here in the density of 3D, but yeah. that there can be so many other explanations of how space is traversed, wormhole being
yeah.
one. Who knows? But I know one thing. It's a very exciting time to be alive when we're finally able to openly discuss these things.
Yeah, well, we will do it. Meaning our civilization will do this. And how, when is unknown, but hopefully it's not in the too far distant future. But we have to settle our own differences, you know, between our nation states before we can really make any progress on this.
Yeah, well, maybe this is going to be one of the catalysts for humankind to finally stop killing each other and to recognize that there's something much bigger going on in the great cosmos of life and consciousness.
Oh, yeah, you bet there is. We're just a minor cog on a great big wheel.
Indeed we are. Well, Jesse, I'm going to sign out now. I'm inviting everybody to investigate again your site. Please give it again because sometimes people don't get it the first time around.
Okay, it's Jesse Marcel.
It's www.jessemarcelsr.com.
Gotcha.
And we've been speaking with Jesse Marcel, the author of The Roswell Legacy, The Untold Story of the First Military Officer at the 1947 Crash Site. Thank you so much for being with us for this eye-opening investigation into an 11-year-old boy's experience of ET connections.
It's been my pleasure, Patricia. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Jesse. Okay, everybody, that's it for today. I'd like to thank you for tuning in. Next week, I have Jim Mars. He's going to be talking about his new book. Don't miss that either. Oh, boy, this book is called Above Top Secret. So once again, we're going beyond the matrix, daring to think outside of the box they, and I'll put that in parentheses, want us to stay in. So be sure to listen in. I will still be in Egypt, but we will have another great interview for you. Don't forget, Patricia Corey, www.syrianrevelations.net. Keep your minds open. Stay in the free thought zone. Bye-bye, everyone. Thank you for listening in.